like to continue with reading a few passages from Vincent's anthology, The Wings to Awakening, continuing with the subject of the abandonment of the hindrances. There's one further quotation concerning the first hindrance of sensual desire. This is a passage from the Teri Gata, which Subha, the nun, was going through Jivaka's delightful mango grove, and a libertine, the goldsmith's son, blocked her path. So she says to this libertine, "What wrong have I done you that you stand in my way? It's not proper, my friend, that a man should touch a woman gone forth. I respect the master's message, the training pointed out by the one well gone. I am pure, without blemish. Why do you stand in my way? You, your mind agitated, impassioned. I, unagitated, unimpassioned, without blemish, with a mind entirely freed. Why do you stand in my way?" Then the young man says, "You're young and not bad looking. What need do you have for going forth? Throw off your ochre robe. Come, let's delight in the flowering grove. A sweetness they exude everywhere, towering trees with their pollen. The beginning of spring is a pleasant season. Come, let's delight in the flowering grove. The trees with their blossoming tips moan, as it were, in the breeze. What delight will you have if you plunge into the grove alone, frequented by herds of wild beasts, disturbed by elephants, rutting and aroused? You want to go unaccompanied into the great, lonely, frightening grove? Like a doll made of gold, you will go about like a goddess in the gardens of heaven. With delicate, smooth, khasi fabrics, you will shine, O beauty, without compare. I would gladly do your every bidding if we were to dwell in the glade, for there is no creature dearer to me than you, O nymph with languid regard. If you do as I ask, happy, come live in my house, dwelling in the calm of a palace. Have women wait on you, wear delicate fabrics, adorn yourself with garlands and creams. I will make you many and varied ornaments of gold, jewels, and pearls. Climb onto a costly bed, scented with sandalwood carvings, with a well-washed coverlet, beautiful, spread with a woolen quilt, brand new, like a blue lotus rising from the water, where there dwell non-human spirits. You will go to old age with your limbs unseen, if you stay as you are in the holy life. What you... Okay, now this is the answer. What do you assume of any essence here in this cemetery grower, filled with corpses, this body destined to break up? What do you see when you look at me, you who are out of your mind? He says, "Your eyes are like those of a fawn, like those of a sprite in the mountains. Seeing your eyes, my sensual delight grows all the more. Like tips they are of blue lotuses in your golden face, spotless. Seeing your eyes, my sensual delight grows all the more. Even if you should go far away, I will think only of your pure, long-lashed gaze, for there is nothing dearer to me than your eyes, O nymph, with a languid regard." And Subha replies, "You want to stray from the road. You want the moon as a plaything. You want to jump over Mount Sineru. You have designs on one born of the Buddha. For there is nothing anywhere at all in the world with its gods that would be an object of passion for me. I don't even know what that passion would be, for it's been killed, root and all, by the past, like embers from a pit, scattered, like a bowl of poison, evaporated. I don't even see what that passion would be, for it's been killed, root and all, by the past. Try to seduce one who hasn't reflected on this, or one who has not followed the master's teaching, but try it with this one who knows, and you suffer. For in the midst of praise and blame, pleasure and pain, my mindfulness stands firm. Knowing the unattractiveness of things compounded, my heart adheres to nothing at all. I am a follower of the one well gone, riding the vehicle of the Eightfold Way. my arrow removed, effluent free, I delight, having gone to an empty dwelling. For I have seen well-painted puppets, hitched up with sticks and strings, made to dance in various ways. When the sticks and strings are removed, thrown away, scattered, shredded, smashed into pieces, not to be found, in what will the mind make there make its home? This body of mine, which is just like that, when devoid of tamas, doesn't function. When devoid of tamas, it doesn't function. In what will the mind there make its home? Like a mural you've seen, painted on a wall, smeared with yellow orpiment, there your vision has been distorted, meaningless your perception of a human being. Like an evaporated mirage, like a tree of gold in a dream, like a magic show in the midst of a crowd, you run blind after what is unreal. Resembling a ball of sealing wax set in a hollow with a bubble in the middle and bathed with tears, eye secretions are born there too. The parts of the eye are rolled all together in various ways. Then Subha, plucking out her lovely eye, with mind unattached, she felt no regret. Here, take this eye, it's yours. Straight away she gave it to him. Straight away his passion faded right there. And he begged her forgiveness. And he said, be well, follower of the holy life. This sort of thing won't happen again. Harming a person like you is like embracing a blazing fire. It is as if I've seized a poisonous snake. So may you be well. Forgive me. And released from there, the nun went to the excellent Buddha's presence. When she saw the mark of his excellent merit, her eye became as it was before. Okay, so that ends the section on sensual desire. We've gone to ill will. There are five ways of subduing hatred, by which when hatred arises in a monk, he should wipe it out completely. Which five? When one gives birth to hatred for an individual, one should develop goodwill for that individual. Thus the hatred for that individual should be subdued. When one gives birth to hatred for an individual, one should develop compassion for that individual, equanimity towards that individual. One should pay him no mind and pay him no attention. When one gives birth to hatred for an individual, one should direct one's thoughts to the fact of his being the product of his karma. This venerable one is the doer of his karma, heir of his karma, born of his karma, related by his karma, and is dependent on his karma. Whatever karma he does, for good or for evil, to that will he fall heir. Thus the hatred for that individual should be subdued. These are five ways of subduing hatred, by which when hatred arises in a monk, he should wipe it out completely. Because of the... that was condensed down. I don't know whether that was the five methods that are clear there. I'll just repeat them. The first one is developing goodwill or metta for that individual. Second one is compassion, karuna. Third is equanimity. The fourth is to pay him no mind and pay him no attention. And last is the reflection on being the heir of his karma, and so on. Next passage is from Anguttara. Venerable Sariputta. There are some people who are impure in their bodily behavior, but pure in their verbal behavior. Hatred for a person of this sort should be subdued. There are some people who are impure in their verbal behavior, but pure in their bodily behavior. Hatred for a person of this sort should also be subdued. There are some people who are impure in their bodily behavior and verbal behavior, but who periodically experience mental clarity and calm. Hatred for a person of this sort should also be subdued. There are some people who are impure in their bodily behavior and verbal behavior, and who do not periodically experience mental clarity and calm. Hatred for a person of this sort should also be subdued. There are some people who are pure in their bodily behavior and their verbal behavior, and who periodically experience mental clarity and calm. Hatred for a person of this sort should also be subdued. Now, as for a person who is impure in his bodily behavior, but pure in his verbal behavior, how should one subdue hatred for him? Just as when a monk who makes use of things that are thrown away sees a rag in the road, taking hold of it with his left foot and spreading it out with his right, he would tear off the sound part and go off with it. In the same way, when the individual is impure in his bodily behavior, but pure in his verbal behavior, one should at that time pay no attention to the impurity of his bodily behavior, and instead pay attention to the purity of his verbal behavior. Thus the hatred for him should be subdued. As for a person who is impure in his verbal behavior, but pure in his bodily behavior, how should one subdue hatred for him? Just as when there is a pool overgrown with slime and water plants, and a person comes along burning with heat, covered with sweat, exhausted, trembling, and thirsty, he would jump into the pool, part the slime and water plants with both hands, and then cupping his hands, drink the water, and go on his way. In the same way, when the individual is impure in his verbal behavior, but pure in his bodily behavior, one should at that time pay no attention to the impurity of his verbal behavior, and instead pay attention to the purity of his bodily behavior. Thus the hatred for him should be subdued. And as for the person who is impure in his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, but who periodically experiences mental clarity and calm, how should one subdue hatred for him? Just as when there is a little puddle in a cow's footprint, a person comes along burning with heat, covered with sweat, exhausted, trembling, and thirsty. The thought would occur to him, here is this little puddle in a cow's footprint. If I try to drink the water using my hand or cup, I would disturb it, stir it up, and make it unfit to drink. What if I were to get down on all fours and slurp it up like a cow, and then go on my way? So he would get down on all fours, slurp up the water like a cow, and then go on his way. In the same way, when an individual is impure in his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, but periodically experiences mental clarity and calm, one should at that time pay no attention to the impurity of his bodily behavior, the impurity of his verbal behavior, and instead pay attention to the fact that he periodically experiences mental clarity and calm. Thus the hatred for him should be subdued. As for a person who is impure in his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, and who does not periodically experience mental clarity and calm, how should one subdue hatred for him? Just as when there is a sick man, in pain, seriously ill, traveling along a road, far from the next village and far from the last, unable to get the foods he needs, unable to get the medicine he needs, unable to get a suitable assistant, unable to get anyone to take him to human habitation. Now suppose another person were to see him coming along the road. He would do what he could out of compassion, pity, and sympathy for the man, thinking, oh, that this man should get the food he needs, the medicine he needs, a suitable assistant, someone to take him to human habitation. Why is that? So that he won't fall into ruin right here. In the same way, when a person is impure in his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, and who does not periodically experience mental clarity and calm, one should do what one can out of compassion, pity, and sympathy for him, thinking, oh, that this man should abandon wrong bodily conduct and develop right bodily conduct, abandon wrong verbal conduct and develop right verbal conduct, abandon wrong mental conduct and develop right mental conduct. Why is that? So that on the breakup of the body after death, he won't fall into the plane of deprivation, the bad destination, the lower realms, purgatory. Thus the hatred for him should be subdued. And as for a person who is pure in his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, and who periodically experiences mental clarity and calm, how should one subdue hatred for him? Just as when there is a pool of clear water, sweet, cool, and limpid, with gently sloping banks, and shaded on all sides by trees of many kinds, and a person comes along, burning with heat, covered with sweat, exhausted, trembling, and thirsty. Having plunged into the pool, having bathed and drunk, and come out again, he would sit down or lie down right there in the shade of the trees. In the same way, when an individual is pure in his bodily behavior and verbal behavior, and periodically experiences mental clarity and calm, one should at that time pay attention to the purity of his bodily behavior, the purity of his verbal behavior, and to the fact that he periodically experiences mental clarity and calm. Thus, the hatred for him should be subdued. An entirely inspiring individual can make the mind grow serene. These are five ways of subduing hatred, by which, when hatred arises in the monk, he should wipe it out completely. There are these 10 ways of subduing hatred. Which 10? Firstly, thinking, he has done me harm, but what should I expect? One subdues hatred. Secondly, thinking, he is doing me harm, but what should I expect? Thirdly, he is going to do me harm, but what should I expect? Four, he has done harm to people who are dear and pleasing to me. But what should I expect? He's doing harm to people who are dear and pleasing to me. But what should I expect? He's going to do harm to people who are dear and pleasing to me. But what should I expect? He has aided people who are not dear or pleasing to me. But what should I expect? He is aiding people who are not dear or pleasing to me. But what should I expect? He is going to aid people who are not dear or pleasing to me. But what should I expect? Thus one subdues hatred. Now, 10, one does not get worked up over impossibilities. These are 10 ways of subduing hatred. And from the Dhammapada, he reviled me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. Now, those who gird themselves this way, their enmity is not quelled. He reviled me, hit me, beat me, robbed me. Those who don't gird themselves this way, their enmity is quelled. Enmity is not quelled by enmity, whatever may be happening here. Enmity is quelled by non-enmity. This is an unending truth. And some passage from the Anguttarang, famous passage on sloth and drowsiness. Once the Blessed One was living among the bhikkhus in the deer park at Besakala Grove near Crocodile Hill. At that time, Venerable Mahamoggallana, prior to his awakening, sat nodding near the village of Kalawalaputta in Magatha. The Blessed One saw this with his purified divine eye, surpassing the human. And as soon as he saw this, just as a strong man might stretch out his bent arm or bend his outstretched arm, disappeared from the deer park, appeared right in front of Venerable Mahamoggallana, and sat down on the prepared seat. As he was sitting there, the Blessed One said to Venerable Mahamoggallana, "Are you nodding, Moggallana? Are you nodding?" "Yes, Lord." "Well then, Moggallana, whatever perception you have in mind when drowsiness descends on you, don't attend to that perception. Don't pursue it. It's possible that by doing this, you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then recall to your awareness the Dhamma as you have heard and memorized it. Re-examine it and ponder it over in your mind. It's possible by doing this you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then repeat aloud in detail the Dhamma as you have heard and memorized it. It's possible that by doing this you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then pull both your earlobes and rub your limbs with your hands. It's possible that by doing this, you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then get up from your seat, and after washing your eyes out with water, look around in all directions and upwards to the major stars and constellations. It's possible that by doing this, you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then attend to the perception of light. Resolve on the perception of daytime, dwelling by night as by day, and by day as by night. By means of an awareness thus open and unhampered, develop a brightened mind. It is possible that by doing this, you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this, you don't shake off your drowsiness, then, percipient of what lies in front and behind, set a distance to meditate, walking back and forth. Your senses inwardly immersed, your mind not straying outwards. It is possible that by doing this, you will shake off your drowsiness. But if by doing this you don't shake off your drowsiness, then, reclining on your right side, take up the lion's posture, one foot placed on top of the other, mindful, alert, with your mind set on getting up. As soon as you wake up, get up quickly, with the thought, I will not stay indulging in the pleasure of lying down, the pleasure of reclining, the pleasure of drowsiness. Thus, Moggallana, should you train yourself. And just read one or two passages from the following section on right concentration. There's these beautiful similes of the mind in jhana. Now, what monks is five-factored noble right concentration? There is the case where a monk, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana. Rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal, accompanied by direct thought and evaluation. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. Just as if a skilled bathman or bathman's apprentice would pour bath powder into a brass basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water, so that his ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. Even so, the monk permeates this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of withdrawal. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. This is the first development of the five-factored noble right concentration. Furthermore, with the stilling of directed thought and evaluation, he enters and remains in the second jhana, rapture and pleasure born of composure, unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of composure. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of composure. Just like a lake with spring water welling up from within, having no inflow from east, west, north, or south, and with the skies periodically supplying abundant showers, so that the cool fount of water welling up from within the lake would permeate and pervade, suffuse and fill it with cool waters, there being no part of the lake unpervaded by the cool waters. Even so, the monk permeates this very body with the rapture and pleasure born of composure. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born of composure. This is the second development of the five-factored noble right concentration. And furthermore, with the fading of rapture, he remains in equanimity, mindful and alert, and physically sensitive to pleasure. He enters and remains in the third jhana, and of him the Noble One declares, equanimous and mindful, he has a pleasurable abiding. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture, so that there is nothing of his entire body unpervaded with pleasure divested of rapture. Just as in a blue, white, or red lotus pond, there may be some of the blue, white, or red lotuses which, born and growing in the water, stay immersed in the water and flourish without standing up out of the water, so that they are permeated and pervaded, suffused and filled with cool water from their roots to their tips. And nothing of those blue, white, or red lotuses would be unpervaded with cool water. Even so, the monk permeates this very body with the pleasure divested of rapture. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded with pleasure divested of rapture. This is the third development of the five-factored noble right concentration. And furthermore, with the abandoning of pleasure and he has his stress issue, as with the earlier disappearance of elation and distress, he enters and remains in the fourth jhana, purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. He sits permeating the body with a pure, bright awareness, so that there is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. just as if a man were sitting wrapped from head to foot with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his body to which the white cloth did not extend. Even so the monk sits, permeating his body with a pure, bright awareness. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by pure, bright awareness. This is the fourth development of the five-factored noble right concentration. And furthermore, the monk has his theme of reflection well in hand, well attended to, well considered, well penetrated by means of wisdom. Just as if one person were to reflect on another, or a standing person were to reflect on a sitting person, or a sitting person were to reflect on a person lying down. Even so, monks, the monk has his theme of reflection well in hand, well attended to, well pondered, well penetrated by means of wisdom. This is the fifth development of the five-factored noble right concentration. When a monk has developed and pursued the five-factored noble concentration, right concentration in this way, then whichever of the six higher knowledges he turns his mind to know and realize, he can witness them for himself whenever there is an opening. Suppose that there were a water jar set on a stand, brimful of water, so that a crow could drink from it. If a strong man were to tip it in any way at all, would water spill out? Yes, Lord. In the same way, when a monk has developed and pursued the five-factored noble right concentration in this way, then whichever of the six higher knowledges he turns his mind to know and realize, he can witness them for himself whenever there is an opening. Suppose there are a rectangular water tank set on level ground, bounded by dikes, brimful of water, so that a crow could drink from it. If a strong man were to loosen the dikes anywhere at all, would water spill out? Yes, Lord. Suppose there are a chariot on level ground at four crossroads, harnessed to thoroughbreds, waiting with whips lying ready, so that the skilled driver, a trainer of tameable horses, might mount, and taking the reins with his left hand and the whip with his right, drive out and back to whatever place and by whichever road he liked. In the same way, when a monk has developed and pursued the five-factored noble right concentration in this way, then whichever of the six higher knowledges he turns his mind to know and realize, he can witness them for himself whenever there is an opening. That's a quote from the Majjhima Vasakara. Once Venerable Ananda, Venerable Gotama, was living at Vaisali in the hall with the peaked roof in the great forest. I went to where he was staying in the great forest, and there he spoke in a variety of ways on jhana. Venerable Gotama was both endowed with jhana and made jhana his habit. In fact, he praised all sorts of jhana. Venerable Ananda replies, it was not the case that the Blessed One praised all sorts of jhana, nor did he criticize all sorts of jhana. And what sort of jhana did he not praise? There is the case where a certain person dwells with his awareness overcome by sensual passion, obsessed with sensual passion. He does not discern the escape as it actually is present from sensual passion once it has arisen. Making that sensual passion the focal point, he absorbs himself with it, desorbs, resorbs, and supersorbs himself within it. Yeah, I don't quite know what that means either. He dwells with... It's untranslatable, isn't it? Yeah. He dwells with his awareness overcome by ill will, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness and anxiety, uncertainty, obsessed with uncertainty. He does not discern the escape as it actually is present from uncertainty once it has arisen. Making that uncertainty the focal point, he absorbs himself with it, desorbs, resorbs, and supersorbs himself with it. This is the sort of jhana that the Blessed One did not praise. And what sort of jhana did he praise? There is the case where a monk, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana, the second jhana, the third jhana, the fourth jhana. Purity of equanimity and mindfulness, neither pleasure nor pain. This is the sort of jhana the Blessed One praised. Vasakara says, it would seem, Venerable Ananda, that the Venerable Gotama criticized the jhana that deserves criticism and praised that which deserves praise. endowed with these five qualities is incapable of entering and remaining in right concentration. Which five? He cannot withstand the impact of sights. He cannot withstand sounds, aromas, tastes, tactile sensations. A monk endowed with these five qualities is not capable of entering and remaining in right concentration. A monk endowed with these five qualities is capable of entering and remaining in right concentration. Which five? He can withstand the impact of sights, sounds, odors, tastes, tactile sensations. A monk endowed with these five qualities is capable of entering and remaining in right concentration. A monk who has not abandoned these six qualities is incapable of entering and remaining in the first jhana, which six, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness and anxiety, uncertainty, and not seeing well with right wisdom as they actually are present, the drawbacks of sensual pleasure. A monk who has not abandoned these six qualities is incapable of entering and remaining in the first jhana, which six, thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of ill will, thoughts of harmfulness, perceptions of sensuality, perceptions of ill will, perceptions of harmfulness.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
The Buddhist teachings, the structure of the Four Noble Truths is used throughout as a way of explaining existence and the way of clarifying the nature of our life and the way to freedom. Sometimes, or in most cases, the exposition is of dukkha, suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path leading to its cessation. But in some cases, we find the same structure applied with different words used. For instance, the world is used as a synonym for dukkha or suffering. And so the Buddha says that his teaches the world, the nature of the world, the arising of the cause for the arising of the world, cessation of the world, and the path leading to the cessation of the world. Another case, he talks about personality or the embodied being and his arising and cessation, the path leading to his cessation. There's a very flexible structure that can be used in a number of different cases. But what this is saying is that dukkha, the world, embodiment, or the sense of being somebody, are all synonymous, they have the same meaning. So when we, I think it's good to remember this when reading or hearing about samsara and the wheel of birth and death, and to remember that that is synonymous with this body and mind. So the wheel of birth and death as we experience it, unless we have developed powers to remember past lives, or if they've appeared spontaneously, for most of us, the vast majority of human beings, our lived experience of samsara, the wheel of birth and death, is this body and mind right now. This is samsara. This is your present experience, is samsara. So your body is samsara, your feelings are samsara, your perceptions, your thoughts, your emotions, your sense consciousness. This is the samsara that you know. This is the personally, presently experienced samsaric realm. And spiritual life, at least in the Buddhist conception, only really begins when you experience the samsaric realm as being like a cage or a prison, and you accept, at least on trust, that it is not given, it is not inherent, innate in the way things are. In other words, there is a door, there is a way in and a way out, that you've entered the prison and that you can leave the prison. This is the teaching of the cause and the cessation. And there is a path, and there is a method. It's not a random thing, or not a matter of fate or of the stars, but your continuation in this imprisoned, constricted state is dependent on your ignorance of the way out, and dependent on that ignorance, of course, is the non-application of the methods and techniques, ways to free yourself from that state. So the Buddha is teaching us always to bring the teachings inwards, to apply them to our own experience. The teachings of Buddhist cosmology. Again, these are things to be brought inwards. How can we study teachings of Buddhist cosmology so that they reduce the unwholesome dhammas and the unwholesome traits in our minds, and encourage and develop wholesome qualities? And this is a criterion that we use in every aspect of our life and experience. How can we relate to people, experiences, situations, and so on in a way which is not exaggerating, increasing the power of unwholesome tendencies, but is, on the contrary, increasing power of wholesome tendencies. Studying any subject, including Buddhist cosmology, there are two ways to go. If it's merely an accumulation of memory, then that's still within samsara, that's still that's not necessarily part of the path yet. So can we use the teachings, can we use the knowledge and the learning, the memory as a way of leading us out of samsara? So really bringing the teachings down to earth. We talk about samsara and the wheel of birth and death and so on. These are tend to be quite exotic terms, or can be sometimes be philosophical in terms. But what the Buddha is talking about is your physical body, your feelings, your perceptions, your thoughts, your emotions, your sense consciousness. This is samsara as it manifests right now. So we don't know how many times we've been born before and in what shape and form. We take on trust, perhaps the Buddha's words as recorded in the suttas, that there are an innumerable number of times that we're to gather all the tears that we've shed in previous lives, and it would expand, be a huge ocean, larger than all the oceans that cover the world today. Innumerable number of lifetimes, but what we can know is the result of all that. The result of all that is this body and mind right now. And that's what you've got to work with. So when we talk about nipita, the sense of disenchantment that arises. It's not disenchantment with the world outside of us. That may be one part of it, but it's the coarser counterpart of the real nipita, which is disenchantment with embodiment, disenchantment with attachment to the physical body, disenchantment with attachment to feelings, disenchantment to perceptions, attachment to perceptions, to thoughts, to emotions, to sense consciousness. This is where the disenchantment has to really arise. Disenchantment towards the physical body is something which arises in many people who don't meditate, but usually only in times of illness or when the body is giving them pain. Well, that's very superficial. Is much more likely to be aversion. Disenchantment is not aversion. It is a moving away from something or putting something down through seeing its nature. Ajahn Chah had many similes to explain this, and their concern with realizing that you've got a snake under the carpet, for instance, or suddenly realizing there's something close to you that you've taken for granted and being quite complacent about is in fact realization that is in fact something very dangerous to you. In the realm of the physical body, it's perhaps easier than in the realm of the mind. And particularly in the realm of sankharas and thoughts and ideas and likes and dislikes, and can see that unless you consciously bring this up, only for myself, I'm constantly reminding myself that this very movement of liking and disliking things is samsara. And this is one of the things that is tying you down, constricting you. In Thai we have this a phrase, samkhanman maya. It's a phrase that denotes the idea of giving something an importance, a reality, a substantiality that it doesn't really possess. And this is how we give life to these mental factors, and give life to like and dislike. And you see how you can live your whole life without waking up to the fact that how you're being conditioned by and imprisoned through this these two mental factors of liking and disliking. And this can last right through to quite advanced levels of spiritual practice sometimes. And you see people who've developed a particular way of practice, have particular ideas about practice, and you say, I like doing it this way. Basically, amid all the various rationale and reasons why it's a good way to practice or a good way to live as a monk are actually secondary to the basic energy, which is I like it. And I remember years ago staying in a monastery and a monk coming to visit me, and he'd been living by himself for quite some time. And he got very grumpy because in the monastery, as in most of our branch monasteries, the chores were at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was kind of fixed kind of standard in most forest monasteries. And every afternoon he'd come out looking really miserable because previously when he was living by himself, the afternoon period, particularly 3 o'clock, was the time where he'd always have the best sitting, the best meditation. And now it's in this very time when he was usually most peaceful, was the time he had to come out and do things that he didn't like doing, and sweeping and cleaning and all those kinds of things. And so he'd be sort of caught up in this miserable mind state, just regretting this peaceful states of meditation, which I think he probably exaggerated through frustration and not being able to have that time to himself. And so he was oppressing himself and creating dukkha for himself out of liking and disliking. You see that so much where, you know, for many people, that light becomes imperative. I do this because I like it. And it's right because I like it. Something else is wrong because I don't like it. Although we may not like to articulate it in that way, it seems childish to us and probably a bit embarrassed, but that's often what's the bottom line is. Liking people, you have to take so seriously these feelings of liking somebody. You know, it's like really something important. You know, I really like that person. I really don't like that person. And you know, as if that's a really profound kind of statement. I mean, there's just how important is it that you like somebody or you don't like somebody? How much reality do you want to give that kind of thought? This is samsara. This is the wheel of birth and death. And notice, the more you like some people, then the more you dislike others. The more you buy into, the more you indulge in liking for people, then the more that you're saddled with dislike for others. And the more that you indulge in liking for certain conditions and certain practices, then the more you will experience dislike for others. It's just part of the nature of life, isn't it? So that's perhaps not such a difficult thing to see, but the crucial point comes where you develop the sense of nipita, where you say, I don't just want to spend my whole life just fluctuating between liking and disliking and going after the things I like and trying to avoid the things I dislike. And it can be such a pervasive attitude to life that you become so used to it you don't see it anymore. And again, it's so important to see the role that intellect and rationalization plays in this, because we've always got good reasons to do the things we like doing and good reasons not to do the things that we don't like doing. So in the monastic lifestyle, we have opportunity to cut through that, to see what paper tigers these kinds of thoughts and feelings are. Like is just like, and dislike is just dislike. And just to see the more bubbles in the mind, and a great kind of lightness that can be experienced when you see that you don't have to just keep following liking and disliking. That's part of the world. Even if you're wearing a robe, you've shaved head, and you're living in the middle of a forest or a charnel ground, if you're still following your likes and your dislikes and your wants and your desires, then you're still in the world, because this is the world, the Buddha said, is the world of or samsara is attachment to the five khandhas, attachment to form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. You take the world with you. This is where we practice. We're practicing wherever dukkha arises, wherever suffering arises, wherever defilement arises. That's the place of work for a practitioner or a meditator. Being able to stand back from this play of thoughts and emotions and ideas and opinions, and just to see its insubstantiality, just to see the maya of it, just how it drags you in. It's like a quicksand bog, a bog of thoughts and opinions and desires and wants and needs and fears and insecurities. And the moment you take them seriously, that means you take it who you are, or that you feel that these mental states say something about you. You make a person out of this flow and stream phenomena, then you're ready to be hit by whatever comes along. It's making a target out of yourself by creating a person. And it's so clear, isn't it, when if you do have some kind of insight into it, that the moment you have any kind of idea about yourself, that you don't see the anything which doesn't fit in with that, and an external level, you can see that with prejudice. Remember after first traveling in Asia and going back to England and talking with my grandfather, who was a wonderful, generous, kind-hearted man, but had many of the prejudices of his social class and generation, and very prejudiced against Indian people. And I was trying to explain to him about how kind I found Indian people, and hospitality I'd met, and so on and so forth. And he came out with all these kind of cliched prejudices about Indian people. And then I said, well, what about Dr. Sharma? His GP is, as in many English people, his GP was an Indian doctor and who'd been treating him for years and years, and was incredibly kind and helpful through my grandmother's last illness before she died. And he said, oh yeah, he's an exception. He's the exception that proves the rule. You know, if a few more were like him, then they wouldn't be so bad. But nothing was going to change his idea about Indian people, even though the only Indian person he'd ever met and had any kind of relationship was actually the polar opposite of every every kind of negative perception that he had. And so, you find in families where husbands and wives are willing to treat each other very badly because they love each other. Because I love you, therefore I have the right to treat you as if I didn't, because it doesn't really mean anything, because really you know that I love you. And then in our life, then you have this idea of yourself as being very kind, perhaps, and then being totally unable to look at the unkind character traits that you have, or you think that you're hopeless, and then you overlook all your very your skills and your good qualities. So the moment that you create this sakaya, as a part of, when you create this person, and you believe it to be something real and lasting, then you've lost it already. You've lost the middle path. And this personality, this whole samsaric muddle, is created moment by moment by attaching to the one out of the five khandhas. To see this process very clearly, and to start examining relationship to pleasant feeling, to unpleasant feeling, to indifferent feeling, the relationship to the memories you have. How much do you believe your memories, and how much do you believe your perceptions of events, people? How much do you believe your own opinions? One way of finding out, but the easy way is, how do you feel when you hear someone expressing an opinion which you disagree with? Do you feel threatened by it? Do you feel angry? Do you feel you've got to stand up and say something? Does it make you feel uncomfortable? This is an indication, isn't it, of attachment. This is an indication of samsaric. So it's a samsaric mode. So our ability to stand back from experience is something that we have to cultivate. Having seen the importance of it and the benefit of it, we have to develop the ability to do it. And our mindfulness practice and our meditation practice is a very important part of this. With the samadhi practice in particular, then we're developing three very very important qualities of mind, if you like. Developing the peace and tranquility and happiness of the mind, developing clarity of mind, developing the power of the mind. And these are things you can see that links of clusters of benefit from meditation practice, the concentration of the mind. One is power, second is power and energy, integrity of mind. Secondly is clarity and pliability, flexibility of mind. And thirdly is the peace, calm, happiness of mind. So a mind which has been trained in meditation is energetic, powerful, it's clear, incisive. You can see things as they are. And it's a happy mind. And the mind without, which has not developed meditation, of course, directly opposite, is a weak, indulgent, trivial, superficial mind, which lacks the ability to see things clearly, and is constantly unhappy and at a loss, and suffers from a sense of lack, inadequacy, and needs some kind of stimulation all the time. So through and development of our meditation practice through dedication to its sincerity in this practice, then the mind becomes stronger. There's an energy to it, a power to it. And the clarity of the Buddha is famously compared to the still forest pool in which someone standing at its edge can look in and see the gravel, the stones, the fish, the plant life at the bottom, within the water. This is the mind which is calmed down, the mind which is still, can begin to see feelings as feelings, thoughts as thoughts, opinions as opinions. You begin to see things without that habitual ownership of them, or taking the perception of them as being self or belonging to self. The temporary laying of that, if not a permanent. And then suddenly the mind which is calm and tranquil and experiencing some the happiness of non-disturbance, that is strong enough to look at the nature of things. This is the happiness, the bliss that is not accessible by in the sensual world. It's the happiness of comparable to good health, in which there are no illnesses afflicting the physical body. This is the happiness of no disturbing mental states in the mind. So tranquility of mind is inherently pleasant. So the practice is one where we have this, we can call it a holistic system, if you like, body, speech, and mind, sila, samadhi, panya, virtue, concentration, and wisdom. And we have to keep on maintaining this very close relationship and connection between these three parts of the path. Can see in certain Buddhist traditions and Buddhist groups where the relationship between morality, between behavior, conduct, concentration, and wisdom is not fully understood. That samadhi practice becomes alienated from the context in which it should be developed, and it can become a mere way of shutting down in the mind, turning away from problems, tranquilizing the mind in the way that Valium or some other chemical tranquilizes the mind. This is not Buddhist samadhi. Buddhist samadhi seeks an increase of heedlessness. If meditation practice leads to meditation should lead to an increase of heedfulness. If it leads to increased heedlessness, then it's not Buddhist samadhi, it's not sama samadhi. And the Buddhist samadhi is one which is based on a foundation of moral conduct, one which is inclining towards the penetration of the nature of existence, because it's only through that clear realization of the nature of body and mind, the nature of samsara, or the nature of the world, that the defilements of mind are abandoned. So this practice is one which requires great perseverance, continuity, and faith. And again, if the grasping attitude of mind, liking, disliking mind, the accumulating mind takes over, then it can distort and corrupt practice. And then perhaps we can feel, oh, I've done enough for today, or I'm not getting anywhere, or nothing's happening, or it's not the way that I'd like it to be. And feelings of frustration can arise, and then that's one level of defilement, the feeling of frustration. And the second level of defilement is you believe it and give importance to it and follow it. So we need skillful means to be able to deal with these obstructions that arise. And I think one useful way is transforming one's attitude to practice as one of, from one of taking to one of giving, and to look on the meditation period as a way of expressing one's devotion, gratitude to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, using the devotional energy of the mind to help us to maintain a continuity of practice. So if it's late at night and you're feeling a bit tired and practice hasn't been going so well and you feel like you just like to crash out, because you think, well, even if I was to sit for another half an hour or walk for another half an hour, I probably wouldn't get peaceful anyway, I'd be better off going and having a rest. You're looking at it from the attitude of what I'm going to get from this period of meditation. But if you look on it as an offering, well, I'm going to offer another half an hour of my time to Buddha Dhamma and Sangha and create merit and dedicate that merit to all sentient beings. And maybe I won't make very much merit for sentient beings the next half an hour, but I'll certainly make more than if I fall asleep and crash out. So it's developing a wise or skillful way of relating to or considering your practice. What's really important, what we're trying, the goal is continuity. Continuity through the four postures during the day, continuity between formal meditation periods and the informal times, creating this stream of awareness, one which can be maintained while we're in social situations or working, whatever, not allowing the samsaric mode to envelop the mind, caught into desires and fears, liking, disliking. That's the world. So the renunciation of the world is the renunciation of identification with liking, disliking, identification with pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, identification with opinions, identification with emotions, seeing them for what they are. This is the renunciation of the world moment by moment. This is the maintaining the mind on the middle path. So there's a continuity of practice, samāpatipatthā, which Ajahn Chah stressed so much in his teachings. So purifying the mind, calming, tranquilizing the mind, inclining towards peace. It's upasamānasati, reflecting on the beauty, the nobility, the breathtaking, the magnificence of the liberated mind, inclining towards that, moving towards it, desiring the freedom from attachment. This is something else which buoys up the mind, carries the mind through difficulties, maintaining sati in every situation. It's the simile is looking on sati as a sword, the warrior's sword. The warrior on the battlefield drops his sword. How does he react? Swiftly picks up the sword. He's afraid of being killed. And this is the attitude that we're taught to have towards our mindfulness and awareness. The moment it slips, we quickly pick it up. He's afraid of being maimed, wounded, killed by the defilements. So developing the samadhi practice, whatever we're doing, putting everything into it, all our heart and mind into every single practice, especially the meditation, not being heedless about it, sloppy about it, but having a sense of respect and total application, strengthening the mind, calming the mind, giving joy, happiness to the mind, for it to carry on to the highest level of the practice in the holy life. So I'd like to offer these reflections to you.